This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Carl Marlantes, who's the author of a new novel called Matterhorn. Hi, Carl. How are you?
I'm just fine. How are you?
Good. Well, and just in case people who are hearing this, I assume most will not have read the book or even know that much about it, Matterhorn does not refer to a mountain in the Swiss Alps, literally, in this book. This is a novel, as it says on the cover, a novel of the Vietnam War, and a big novel, I would say, and one that I got to say I really, really liked reading. This is a tremendous book, and I measure that by how many nights I stayed up really late reading. You got me here with this book.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a pretty interesting story about this book. I know that I think people should hear some of these things. First, I just wanted to ask you about your experience then, and you know how you came to write this book, how long it took, when did you start, all those kinds of things.
Yeah. I was graduated from high school in 1963, and back in those days it was a small then logging town. Now it's a resort town in Oregon. Every boy did what was called the service. That's the way it was referred to. It's sort of like, you know, you're over a country, you know, 3 years or 2 years in the service. And, you know, if you were a good athlete, you joined the Marines. And so that's what I did. And but I got a scholarship to Yale, and I was able to go into what's called a PLC program, which meant I could go to Yale and as a reservist. I was a Lance Corporal in the Marine Corps Reserve. I'd gone through boot camp and all that. But then I owed them 3 years when I got out, but it would be as an officer.
And so did you have to go to OCS as well?
No, that was taken care of by this program called PLC, which was essentially it was OCS, but we did it in the summers. And then when you graduate, they send you to what's called the basic school, but you're already commissioned. In other words, you've made it through. They wash the people out over the course of the three or four years that you're going there in the summers.
And so when you went into the Marines, it was after you graduated from college, so it would have been 1967?
That's correct. Except there was a hiatus in there because I won the Rhodes Scholarship and I went to Oxford. I thought, oh, God, the Marines aren't going to let me go because the war was going on. So I wrote them, and they were great. They said, wonderful opportunity. They just assigned me to England. But I was there. And I felt really bad because a lot of the people that I'd gone through training with were in Vietnam, and a lot of my high school friends were over there. One had already been killed, and I just felt like I was kind of hiding behind the privilege of the scholarship. And so, you know, I had this girlfriend say, "Well, go to Sweden." And I don't know; it's hard to remember those times, those kinds of choices that people were making. But I just felt I had to do A or B, and so I wrote a letter to the Marines, and I think it took them about 2 weeks before I was in Quantico. And then, so I actually arrived in Vietnam in fall of 1968. And I was an infantry platoon commander, and then I came back, and luckily I got my scholarship back and finished up and started writing a book, and this is sort of the saga of the book. First thing I did is I said, I'm writing a novel about the war, and was 1,700 pages, if you can believe that. Double spaced.
And when did you? No, but at what
that was
period?
Like about 1972 or 3.
Right, so it's still fairly fresh.
Really fresh, and it was crap. I mean, but it was great psychoanalysis, self psychoanalysis. But I mean, I finished it and I looked at it. I went, this is not a novel, but it was very useful. I have a friend who threatens me. He says, I know I have a copy of it in my garage someplace. I just hope he never finds it. I don't have a copy of it. So what I did is then I went back and I said, okay, I'm going to learn how to really write fiction. And I started reading books and things that writers do. And I started writing the current novel, Matterhorn, about 1975. And because I remember I starting to try and sell it just before my first child was born, which is 1977. It was a big book, and the reaction of agents and publishers was, nobody wants to read about this war. I mean, we want to forget about this war.
Right, because at that time it had just more or less just ended.
Yeah, and so I went, and they said, and you're going to have to cut it back. It's still too big. So, I had to start earning money, tap dance lessons and straightening out teeth. But I kept working on it, and I cut it back. Whole characters, whole storylines went out, and I tried to sell it again in the mid-'80s. And then it was really almost comic. It's comical now. It was like, Vietnam. Well, that's been done. Hollywood already did it. There's no market for it. Full Metal Jacket, Platoon. Okay. And so I went back and I kept working on it and, doing my business. And mid-'90s, I made another run at it. And it was like, well, maybe if you could switch it to the Gulf War or something, we might be able to sell it. You know where this is heading. I mean, literally, in the aughts, it would be like, well, can you put it on a hilltop in Afghanistan? Nobody would read it. It was just astounding. And I had read all the books, how to write the killer query letter, how to find the agent who will sell for you. And you see these books, they're everywhere, and they're useful, but I apparently didn't learn how to do it well because I could never get anybody to read it until one day, a friend of mine had the manuscript. Old friend of his calls him on the phone. He'd gone to college at Berkeley with him, and this man's name is Tom Farber. And my friend asked Tom, "What you doing?" Tom says, "I've started this little literary house called Elion Literary Arts. And we do fiction and fine photography for people that, generally can't get it into the commercial market. They go out and get grants, and the grants support the novels that they select." And so my friend says, "Well, I got a pretty good manuscript here." And he says, "Well, why don't you just have the guy send it to my senior editor, Kit Duane?" So my friend calls me. He's pretty excited. He says, "Send it to this woman in Berkeley." And I said, "Ken, it's going to cost me $50 to make a copy of this, and you want me to send it, a book about Marines in Vietnam, to a woman who lives in Berkeley, California?" And he went, "Yes, send it to her." She loved it. That was the breakthrough. And Tom Farber published it. And that was 2007. It was late fall. And so then by the time we sort of got it through the process, it was going to be published in May of last year. My wife came up with the idea. She said, "Why don't you have El Leon submit it to a bunch of contests?" Because, see, we would still be responsible for selling the book. El Leon is a wonderful little house, but like Tom said, he says, we don't have any marketing capability. We can, help you with blurbs and that sort of thing, but he says, you're going to have to sell it yourself. And my pay was my 120 free copies, but I was delighted to be published by them. And so Elion submitted it to the Barnes & Noble Discovery program, Discover Great New Writers, and Barnes & Noble really liked it, and they kept asking for more copies from Elion, and finally went all the way up to, their management, and Cecily Hensley, who is their chief buyer, said, "If we choose this book, it's going to bury this little outfit in Berkeley." And I know that's true because they had no money. Tom said, I said, "What happens if we win?" He said, "I don't know. Have you got any money?" But so Cecily sent the book to people in the industry that she knew and said, these people need a partner because this is a good book, but they're going to have somebody with, they can market it. It has the clout. And Morgan Entrecon of Grove Atlantic read it. And he said he was halfway through it. He called Farber on the phone and said, "What's the deal? What can we do?" And Morgan made this wonderful offer to Farber. I don't know the details, but very supportive of this little house in Berkeley. And basically they joint ventured, although all the heavy lifting is now being done by Grove Atlantic. And they started putting it out, and then the independents got behind it. And so, I mean, I was very fortunate. I had, you know, Barnes & Noble broke through, and then the independent community have been just wonderful about it. I mean, they started sending emails, and this is a great book. What can we do to help it? And I've been very, very, thankful for the support from both of those communities.
Well, so it's a great story, and you know, it's unusual because I'm sure there are many other great books that, you know, maybe have not had the benefit of that good fortune. But I'm glad that this happened to you in this book, and it gave me a chance to read it. You know, I got a copy from Grove Atlantic, and I think that it's, you know, I don't know, I don't want to just compare you to other war novels, although that comparison is hard not to do. But I am curious that have you read, you know, and again, some of the quotes I've read about the book, you know, obviously people will bring up some of the great war books, like from World War II, which is particularly strong for fiction, I think. But have you read a lot of those books, or did you kind of just bring this forth out of, you know, your own experience and imagination?
No, I've read most of the well-known ones. World War One, Graves, Sassoon, Wilfred Owen's poetry, World War Two, Jones, Norman Mailer, of course, Catch 22, one of the first of the surrealistic novels about war.
And then Slaughterhouse Five, which is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, have you? What about Vietnam? I mean, do you? What do you think about? You know, obviously, the Tim O'Brien is the one that people probably know the best. But are there any other novels from Vietnam that you think highly of?
Yeah, I Tim O'Brien is a great writer, and I really, really like to read him. And but he, you know, going after Cacciato is a different sort of a vein than mine. I mean, his was more or less falling, I think, in that surrealistic mode. It's extremely well done. And then he got, of course, very much more, I don't know the word is, traditional, real.
Yeah,
with,
realistic.
The things they carried. And that was, those stories were very, very good. There's been some other, you know, good books, but quite frankly, I think that the nonfiction books have been the stronger books, in, you know, than a lot of the novels that have come out. What am I thinking of, like Dispatches or Rumors of War?
Yeah, it's funny. I think years ago, I mean, your story of the change in the way people received the novel when you sent it to them over the years sort of reminded me of discussions I remember from those eras. You know, initially, I think the idea was Vietnam was such a painful experience politically and culturally and socially for America that it was difficult for writers to imagine it and present it in some meaningful way, and clearly difficult for readers to come to terms with. And it is sort of interesting that now it's 40 years later, more than 40 years later, and your book really, I thought, captured that era. You know, I was not myself in Vietnam, and I think that's something everyone who is from that era, we used to talk about it. You know, whether when you'd meet somebody, that question was, were you there?
Right.
Were you here? What was, you know, what did you do? You know, what was your role? What was your position politically or, you know, just positionally? But the writing style is very smooth and clear. Some of the things that you talked about reminded me of things that I hadn't thought of in a long time. You know, some of the characters talking about, particularly the black characters talking about, you know, the politics of that day and what was going on between black and white people in the late 60s. I thought you captured that really, really well.
Thank you. No, I mean, I think that we have made progress. I mean, people, even people who lived through the 60s, tend to forget that the cities were going up in flames. I mean, people were shooting from windows. There was sniper fire. There was, it was incredible. And then you think about, you know, you think you have racial tension in America. You take a bunch of 19-year-olds with 30 times the testosterone going through their bodies, and you give them all M16s and say, now we want you to get along. The military in Vietnam is where I think integration really happened. I mean, the newspapers were all about the schools, but I think the military made it happen. Truman, I think, integrated the military in 1948 by law. But in reality, when people really said, these people are I can trust, these people are as competent as I am, maybe more competent, that happened in the military. And I think that I always want to give credit where it's due.
Well, you have one of these, you know, I mean, you have so many great characters in this book, and of course many of them die, and it's really, you know, painful and sad. But there was a, you know, fairly early in the book, you have the two guys who were really close friends, you know, one black, one white, and you talked a lot about their background and, you know, how they became friends. And of course, I think in the end, both of them die, which, you know, is, I mean, I guess there is a lot of death in this book, and it's hard to avoid. But I presume there was a lot of death for you.
Oh, yeah.
I guess that's another question. Do you, you know, the people that were there that you were with, you know, and you the way you've written about them is very loving and respectful of even the ones who I think maybe you didn't care for personally, you know, that your character, the main character, cares about people.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, you know, that sense of, you know, the comrades in arms idea is very powerful. But, you know, when you were writing this, you know, and it is, you know, unavoidably, I know, somewhat autobiographical because it reflects a place that you were in that obviously made a huge impact on you. But are the characters themselves made up for the most part?
Yeah, the characters are mostly made up. I suppose every writer has to admit that characters come out of the writer. So there's some part of me, conscious or unconscious, that's in there. But, you know, I mean, like people say, you know, were you Melis? You know, it's like if I was half the politician that he was, I'd be 100 times richer, more powerful, but not.
Or you'd be dead.
Yeah. That's true, too. But I did, you know, the characters went through experiences that I experienced, and most of the experiences that they experience in the novel, I either saw myself or I have close friends who related the stories of it to me. And that's true. One of the things that just occurred to me is that one of the advantages that happened from that long wait, sort of for getting it published, is that I got older and wiser, and I think my characters gained more depth because of my maturing over that, you know, 30-year time period.
Right. No, I think that's a really crucial point, that the experiences that you were able to capture, while you were younger, are therefore saved for you, but the ability to understand and use that experience is benefits from your distance from the actual events.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. If I ever find an early draft from 30 years ago, I'm quite sure a lot of the characters are more shallow. I mean, one thing is I know that I did not get into the racial stuff in the early drafts. I was a little afraid of it. I mean, I'll put it bluntly. You get older and you sort of go like, well, you know, I got to just take a chance here, and if I don't get it right, I don't get it right, but at least I'll have made a try. And the other thing that I think is interesting about, you know, maturing is that I don't see any of the villains in the novel as villains in the sense of that they're bad people. They're people that fall short. They drink too much. They're a little bit ambitious. The thing that I'm trying to point out is that we all have these human failings But in ordinary life, I mean, you know, if you're in business and you sort of are a little bit too ambitious, or you know, drink too much the night before, you know, maybe there's a penny per share on the bottom line if it's an enormous problem or somebody gets fired unjustly. But these very same human failings that we all have in the context of war have enormous consequences. Enormous.
I mean, well, yeah, and that's something that I felt very strongly in reading the book, that you know, the decisions that people made, particularly, you know, it might be officers, and I think you were very and fairly so, although again, it's not my personal experience, but you're quite critical from the bottom up of the way the war was run at higher levels. And I thought that was also maybe a product of your ability to see widely, or you know,
yeah,
see the whole picture in some level of complexity. You know, you, and as you just said, that you see the you give those higher level commanders their due as human beings who are capable of failings, but of course the results are massively painful,
right,
and devastating in some cases to the people who are who they are commanding.
Right.
I thought that was very, you know, that was profound, and you know, the sort of you know, there's no preachiness in this book, which I really liked. You know, you're letting the story be told, but clearly that's something that you felt either then or later. I'm not sure which.
I think that I got more compassion for them later, because I ended up myself running a corporation and sort of sitting in the big chair. And it's like, you know, I mean, they're still the same people that they were when they were 18, you know, but so I had to have some compassion, but I do not have compassion for people that are arrogant about it. It's like, you know, that's the problem. You get people who drink too much or get lazy, and then it's sort of like, you know, it's everybody else's fault. And that's where I don't have any tolerance. It's like, you know, take the responsibility for being human.
Right. Well, and of course, you know, as you say, that although in war the effects can be magnified when the person who has that power fails. But actually, we could say that that's true in business and life as well. You know, it may not mean that someone is going to get shot, but it may mean that a company fails because of the hubris of management, and a lot of people lose their jobs and their livelihoods and suffer because of that human failing.
Exactly. And that failure, and where I point the finger is that failure to have the integrity to say, you know, I'm not perfect, I'm going to try and do it right.
Right.
It's the arrogance that really starts to hurt
right
down the line.
Well, on the other side of the arrogance is the lack of self-awareness.
Exactly.
To not recognize your own failings and to be willing to lean on the support of others and the judgment of others, and not to feel like it's a sign of weakness if you need to get help.
Yeah.
But of course, in the military at that time, I can't speak for it now, but at that time, certainly, were one of your characters, and I'm thinking of maybe the you know, the colonel,
mm-hmm,
what were he to say, I don't know what to do here, please help me, he would have been in big trouble.
He would have been afraid of looking weak and indecisive and all of the above. And the great commanders, I always think about George Washington. It was a close run, I don't know what you call it, counter-revolution. His officers were so disgusted with Congress because they weren't getting paid, they had no equipment, that they had decided to revolt and mutiny. And he came in to them, and they were really angry. And for the first time, he put on a pair of spectacles to show to them that he was getting old and he couldn't read without them. And he melted them. And and he said, don't do this. But if he hadn't shown that vulnerability, I think that that anger of theirs would have just, you know, it may have changed the whole history of the country. putting on a pair of spectacles. But
right.
That's why Washington was great.
Well, it is true. The great people know what it takes to lead a bunch of other individuals. But I think it may be that's something that's very hard to teach.
Yeah. Well, that's what the main character Melis learns. He has to learn compassion. And if you'll remember at the beginning of the story, he loses a key squad leader, Fisher, and all he can think about is, how am I going to replace him?
Right.
And by the end, it's like, you know, how are you feeling? Does this hurt? I mean, are you okay? That's a major character arc.
Well, he definitely, and again, I don't want to give away too much to anybody
right.
who might want to read it, but clearly in a short period of time, because this book, you know, it's a long book, but it's really complex, but it takes place in a relatively short period.
Yeah.
Lots changes.
Well,
you know, he becomes a whole other person.
Yeah. No, that's right. I think that one of the things that I wanted to try and bring out was the experience of being there, how intense it is. People change in combat enormously fast. You live years of your lives in months in terms of growing up. I mean, that's what they talk about. You know, 19-year-old kid comes back an old man.
Right.
Clearly
the experience, and it reflects in the book itself. The experience is hugely powerful, incredibly challenging, not always pretty.
No,
but it is what it is. As in fact, almost the saying in the book. You had some great expressions, but the one I thought, you know, kind of stuck with me is "there it is."
There it is. It's very Buddhist. Yeah,
right.
This is there it is.
It's a kind of fatalistic acceptance.
Yeah.
And again, the lawyers say it is what it is.
Yeah.
The soldiers say there it is.
There it is.
You know, I love that.
Yeah.
And this is a book that I really loved, and I hope that other people will come to this book and feel the same way. I think it's a terrific novel.
Okay.
I want to thank you for talking to me, Carl. This has been David Wilk talking with Carl Marlantes, the author of Matterhorn. It's a new novel coming out, I think it's in, well, is it out now?
It goes on sale the 23rd, which is next Tuesday.
23rd of March. Okay, because this will probably air after it's out, so people who hear this will be able to go and buy the book. Anyway, this is David Wilk for Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Carl Marlantes, the author of Matterhorn, and thank you so much, Carl.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for having me here.